Welcome to Five Books for Catholics, where an expert selects and explains five outstanding books on some aspect of Catholic life, doctrine, or culture. Distributism is an economic theory that advocates for the widespread ownership of the world's productive assets, rather than their concentration in the hands of a few. Distributism was developed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It is based on Catholic social teaching, especially that of Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum and Pope Pius XI's encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. The theory asserts that the means of production should be owned by as many people as possible, rather than being controlled by a small number of wealthy individuals or corporations. The idea is to create a more equitable society where wealth is distributed more evenly and people have greater control over their own lives. In this interview, Professor Alexander W. Salter will discuss distributism, its principles, history, and also some of the critiques made against it, as well as discussing his recommended books on the subject. Alexander W. Salter is the George G. Snyder Associate Professor of Economics in the Rawls College of Business at Texas Tech University. He is the Comparative Economics Research Fellow at TTU's Free Market Institute and an Associate Editor of the Journal of Private Enterprise. Additionally, he is a Sound Money Project Senior Fellow and a Young Voices Senior Contributor. He is author of The Political Economy of Distributism, Property, Liberty, and the Common Good, published by Catholic University of America Press, The Spirit of 76, Libertarianism and American Renewal, published by the American Institute for Economic Research, and he's the co-author of Money and the Rule of Law, Generality and Predictability in Monetary Institutions, and The Medieval Constitution of Liberty, Political Foundations of Liberalism in the West. His five recommended books on distributism are, first, The Servile State by Hilaire Belloc. Second, An Essay on the Restoration of Property by Hilaire Belloc. Third, An Outline of Sanity by G.K. Chesterton. Fourth, A Humane Economy by Wilhelm Rübke. And fifth, The Economics of the Free Society by Wilhelm Rübke. Professor Stolten, welcome.
Thank you, Father Farrell. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, could you tell us what is distributism?
I'm happy to do that. Distributism is a school of political economic thought that is explicitly rooted in Catholic social teaching. It is not solely Catholic. One does not have to be a Catholic to appreciate distributism, but the progenitors of distributism in the early 20th century were explicitly rooting their teachings in the social teachings of the Catholic Church. And in short, distributism holds that the best kind of society in terms of politics and economics is one characterized by a widespread and diffused ownership of productive assets. Distributists sometimes joke that they love private property so much they want there to be much more of it. They want the average household, the ordinary family, to own the means of production and sustenance of their livelihood.
And how does distributism differ from capitalism?
The distributists often have unkind words for the system that we call capitalism. Most distributists, such as Hilaire Belloc, who was a French and English member of parliament even at one point in the early 20th century, also a giant in the field of distributism, he and many other distributists thought that capitalism tended towards monopoly. And the key feature of monopolistic capitalism, according to them, was that it tended to dispossess the masses of meaningful ownership of the factors of production. And so while there was nominally private ownership by large corporate entities under capitalism, the fact that most families and most households did not own any productive assets meant that the character of a decentralized and free and humane political economic order could not be met. I will add that I have some reservations about the distributist indictment of capitalism, but I still find their ethical worldview, especially their concern with dignity for ordinary families, highly worthwhile and worth taking seriously.
But in your view, what would be an acceptable definition of capitalism? Is there an acceptable definition from the Christian standpoint?
That's a very good question. I'm an economist by training, and so I tend to see capitalism as synonymous with simply an economy characterized by private ownership of the factors of production, a private property economy, without respect to distribution. So what makes the distributist claim unique is they explicitly incorporate distributive, unsurprisingly, claims about their definition of capitalism. They indict capitalism because they think it necessarily tends towards monopoly and excess concentrations of wealth. In some of my writings, I have indicted capitalism because I see one of the features of many systems that self-explicitly identify as capitalist is that they often provide space for political and economic insiders to rewrite the rules of the game to favor them and other special interest groups. And so the retention of nominal private property rights and hence wealth and residual claimancy, all these things that normally do good things in economics, when you add that to the fact that some with preferential access to the commanding heights of politics and economics can often rig the game, so to speak, that might be something that you tend to view as ethically suspect in capitalism. And I think that it's worthwhile to take those defects seriously.
On the other hand, how does distributism differ from socialism?
Distributists also don't like socialism very much. Again, they want as much private property in as many hands as possible. And so when they hear plans and proposals to abolish private property, and that's what socialism is. Socialism, by definition, means abolishing private property rights, investing all productive control over production and distribution in the hands of some body, such as the government. They look at that and they see a recipe for tyranny. They look at that and they see a recipe for the trampling of human dignity. And I think historically speaking, they're absolutely right. When you look at the performance of actual command economies that pass by the name socialist, they're disasters in terms of their effects on the well-being of actual flesh and blood human beings. So while the distributist would be sympathetic with socialist desire for more economic equality, especially with respect to ownership, the distributists could not go so far as to abolish private property. They frequently point back to the teachings of St. Thomas Aquinas and the positive role that he had for private property in orienting us to our temporal and our ultimate final good.
But distributism, I suppose, differs not only from socialism in terms of their economic policy, but the church's understanding of property, which is behind the contributions of authors such as Belloc and Chesterton, is based on its conception of the family and marriage. So I suppose distributors would also differ radically from, let's say, today's left-leaning advocates of social justice and radical inclusion.
Yes, that's a very good point. And this is something that G.K. Chesterton is especially eloquent on. His writings in the early 20th century, What's Wrong with the World in particular, Outline of Sanity is also good on this. For distributists, the basic unit of society is not the individual. It is the family. It is the household. And the concern of distributists is trying to get households as economically independent and sustainable and productive as possible. This idea that if each family has sufficient productive assets to be their own masters economically, not only are they safe from being dictated to in the economic sphere, but they're also going to have a stake in the social order. And it's those kinds of households and families that are going to have an interest in preserving the basic character of a free state that preserves human dignity. So absolutely, you have to think about all this in the context of Catholic social teaching as applied to the family. And this is one area where I think that even non-Catholics, Christians who are not in submission to Rome, can actually find lots of that's valuable, because the family is obviously a normative institution within all of Christianity, or at least it should be. The importance of the family in providing intergenerational stability, an institution ordained by God to help us find our temporal and our final good. This is something that's very important, and we have to think about more than just individuals and social groups. There are important spaces there that I think are quite literally sacred, and we have to make space for those in any sort of sane political and economic order.
Another Recently, over the last few years, there's been some talk about a common good capitalism, whatever maybe. How do distributism differ from some of these recent proposals for common good capitalism?
The conversation about distributism really predates the common good capitalism discussion. As you noted, that's something that's come into prominence fairly recently. In my book that I wrote on this topic, I argue that distributism is one way of envisioning and institutionalizing really common good capitalism. If you're concerned with reforming the way that market economies work such that they more explicitly serve the common good, according to one's conception of the common good, then distributist teachings on the relationship between political and economic order, the importance of decentralized property ownership, the importance of a participatory, non-monopolized economy, I think a lot of this fits well with what public figures such as Senator Marco Rubio have been calling for when they're advocating reorienting the American political economic order towards one that is more robust and rich in its incorporation of considerations about the common good. Again, as an economist, as someone who studies the often very big wedge between our good intentions and our good results, I have some reservations about this, but I certainly think that it's a conversation that's worth having.
Currently, are there any political parties that espouse or propose distributism in the manifesto?
Neither of the two major political parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, do so. There is a third party, the American Solidarity Party, which explicitly builds on both distributist principles and Kuyperian social teaching, which is a Calvinist school of thought. But Abraham Kuyper's writings, he was a Dutch Calvinist and also prime minister from the 19th and early 20th centuries. His writings were very similar and echo a similar chord here in the importance of decentralization and the importance of humaneness in political and economic order. So the American Solidarity Party is one group that, although it has not had great electoral success yet, is explicitly incorporating these teachings and is explicitly building on these insights and the insights of related schools and its paradigm. And you can very easily find that on their website. You don't have to click around very much before they just come right out and say, we are heavily influenced by distributism. We think that this basic vision is correct and this accords to the common good. And so that's what we're pushing.
You're Orthodox, not Catholic, if I've understood correctly. And distributism develops from Catholic tradition, even though it's not necessary. It's not, let's say, commitment to Catholic belief isn't necessary to endorse or recognize any truth claims which distributism, any valid truth claims that distributism makes. Are there differences of substance between Catholic social teaching on economics and Orthodox teaching? Or is it more a difference of method and sources?
It's difficult to talk about Orthodox social teaching since we don't have anything like a compendium of social doctrine. We do have various statements put out by the patriarchates on social matters, but it does not amount to a self-conscious body of teaching about the proper relationship between political, economic, civil society, and other social spheres. I got into distributism because I was returning to Christianity late in college, early in graduate school. And one of the pathways back to Christianity for me was G.K. Chesterton. And from Chesterton, I started reading Hilaire Belloc, and they cultivated in me an appreciation for many of these ethical considerations that I had not previously thought were all that important. Upon reading them, they convinced me that, no, they actually are very serious and very, very important. And so ultimately, even though I converted to Eastern Orthodoxy rather than Catholicism, I retained my love of these authors and their way of viewing political and economic problems. And from them, I also started reading much more significantly into Catholic social teaching, the papal encyclicals, the portions of the catechism that deal with social matters. And that journey back to Christianity, although I ultimately ended up crossing the Bosphorus instead of the Tiber, is one of the reasons that I'm so fond of this paradigm and why I think I'm engaged in it as a research topic.
And you're not a distributist, but you are a sympathetic critic of distributism. To what school of economics do you belong?
That's increasingly a tough question. Perhaps in years past, I could give you a definite answer. I think that I am more ecumenical in my economic beliefs than I was previously. I'm less willing to identify with a specific school. I'm happy to say that in some ways I'm influenced by the Austrian School of Economics, and in other ways I'm influenced by the Chicago School. The way that I try and look at economic problems is I see economics as a descriptive science that teaches us about the way that the world works. I relieve economics as a social science from any burden of teaching us the way that the world ought to work. So I think that there is such a thing as socially scientific economics that can uncover true knowledge about the social world, however we want it or don't want it to be. From there, we have to take our economic teachings and apply them to moral issues. This is not an excuse to ignore morality. This is actually calling for understanding what economics can and cannot teach us. So I would say that the science of economics, the purpose of that science is to serve the art of political economy. And political economy is the more broad humanistic field that explicitly incorporates ethical considerations, and I would argue theological considerations. The basic truths of Christianity are true. Everyone should subscribe to them. And so because Christianity is true, what it teaches about society should be true. And so in any normative ethical investigation about how we order our common affairs, the revealed truths of Christianity are going to have to play a role in that conversation. And I want to see if I can find ways of bringing these social scientific findings of economics to help us do that.
I mean, one of the problems I find with, and I greatly admire the Austrian economists, but one of the problems I find is, without denying the validity of their economics, sometimes they incorporate underlying implicit anthropological or theses. There's an underlying conception of man sometimes. That's particularly clear, I think, in Rothbard, to some extent also in von Mises. Hayek is more nuanced, but if I've understood you correctly, you would say, yes, I agree with them economically, but I have some problems perhaps with the political or the ethical conception, which sometimes implicitly, perhaps unconsciously, they bring in.
I think what's admirable about economists like Mises and Rothbard, and even Hayek, is they actually understand when they're transgressing the positive normative boundary. They actually understand where they're being ethical versus what the bounds of social science alone can take them. And it's true that I often disagree with their anthropology. Mises, for example, was a consequentialist and what's called a rule utilitarian. He believed that we could try and devise social rules that just gets everybody all the stuff that they want, to put it as basically as possible. And I think that that's an interesting way of looking at ethical problems. But of course, for a Christian, we can always think of situations where people should not get what they want, because oftentimes we want bad things because we are sinful. And so I can appreciate the contribution of them as economists without necessarily subscribing to their ethical beliefs. But on this issue, I actually think that Mises and Hayek and Rothbard deserve lots of credit because they are explicit almost always about where their descriptive economics ends and their prescriptive ethical vision begins. Most economists are not that explicit. Many practicing economists today smuggle in their ethical views under the auspices of positive value-free social science. And when you interrogate it, it turns out that it's anything but value-free and anything but descriptive. It is smuggled anthropology, smuggled ethics that's trying to be disguised under a nominally scientific heading. Now, there's nothing wrong with having ethical beliefs and having those ethical beliefs inform your scientific analysis. But I think that there's a big problem when we don't recognize what we're doing when we allow those ethical prior beliefs to impinge upon our scientific studies. Certainly nobody could envision a doctor not caring about human health. Every doctor becomes a doctor presumably because they are ethically committed to taking sickness and destroying it and restoring health, right? Cultivating and restoring the health of the human person. But that being said, science is a medicine. Science is a medicine. That being said, science is a medicine is a science. How many times can I get that wrong? Medicine is a science, right? Some things work, some things don't. The human body works in predictable ways. Some treatments have predictable consequences. And so you need to, if you want to actually achieve your moral purpose, use the science of medicine in the right way. if you start conflating the moral purposes of medicine with the actual scientific practice of medicine, you're not going to get anything you want. You're not going to help people get better, and you're not going to understand what it is you're doing in your own medical practice. In many ways, I view economics similarly. You have to be very clear about where your descriptive beliefs end and your prescriptive beliefs begin. And then you can just be honest about how you think the world works and how you think the world should work.
Now, in your book, if I can, from what I gather, your position would be distributism gets some things right, some things wrong. It gets the political part of political economy right, or at least some aspects of it, but it gets the economics wrong. Is that a fair assessment of what's right and wrong with distributism?
I think that that goes a lot of the way to getting towards my contribution. In the book, I advance what I call a minor claim and a major claim. The minor claim is that distributist authors such as Bellick and Chesterton often make errors in their analysis of how market economies actually work. So if you go and read their indictments of capitalism, by which they mean market economies largely, they say lots of things that simply do not hold up to scholarly scrutiny. We have a better understanding now about the way that markets do and do not work. Now, a lot of economists will use that as a reason or an excuse to dismiss the distributists because they see distributism as nothing other than a school of economic thought. But my major claim in the book is even though they made these small-scale errors, their big picture vision offer something very valuable to us. Because what the distributists are actually doing is offering a theory of the free society. They're discussing a relationship between politics and economics that helps both economy and polity preserve in respecting human dignity. And in many ways, they're talking about the institutional prerequisites of maintaining human dignity. And on that, I think they have a lot to say that's worth listening to. We shouldn't dismiss them so quickly because they got the small stuff wrong when they're getting so much interesting and right in their big picture analysis about what can and often does go wrong in societies that are excessively materialistic or excessively politically centralized.
Did the Spanish scholastics get more right than the distributists? Because you have scholars such as Schumpeter, Rothbard, Marjorie Grice recognizing the contributions that the Spanish scholastics made to economics and developments. Would they be even better than on economics, let's say, than the distributors?
I know many economists who would think so. I myself have not read the Spanish scholastics all that much. I have read excerpts of some of their work on just price theory, for example, but I have to confess that I'm not sufficiently schooled in the school of Salamanca in the Spanish economists of the, I believe, the 16th and early 17th centuries to say whether their vision differs significantly from the distributists, and if it does, whether theirs is the better way of looking at it.
The first before I go into the books, in a debate, it's always important to consider the best arguments of each side. In your book, The Political Economy of Distributism, you argue against some aspects of distributism, which you've already mentioned. What counterarguments might distributors make in reply to your book?
I think a lot of distributists would say that I'm relying a little bit too much on theory and not enough on practice. So, for example, I push back against the claim that capitalism operating by itself will naturally tend towards monopoly and concentration. And I think that I have pretty good theory and evidence for why that claim is ultimately not sustainable. I think a distributist would reply to that. That may be well and good in terms of ideal theory, but if you look at the actual real world operation of the political and economic spheres, it is the case that economic power can buy political power and political power can create economic power. And so because of that, however markets might work in the abstract, it is the case that in any actually existing capitalist system, insiders are going to rewrite the rules of the game to favor themselves, and that's going to necessarily result in concentration, monopoly, and dispossession. And of course, I would have a reply to that, and they could have a reply to that. And so I think that a lot of it hinges on the applicability of economic theory to describing our current circumstances. Obviously, I'm an economist. I very much believe in economic theory. I believe in the power of the economic way of thinking. I am also sympathetic to, or at least I'm willing to tolerate, and I'm willing to consider that perhaps that way of looking at contemporary issues is a little bit too abstract and rarefied. I will defend economic theory to my dying day, but I'm perfectly willing to have a conversation with somebody who thinks, no, there's something that you're missing here, and we need to pay a little more attention to practical reality and a little less attention to how these things work on the blackboard.
And the title of F.A. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom sounds remarkably similar to that of Belloc's The Servile State. Did Hayek quotes Belloc appreciatively in The Road to Serfdom? He even opens chapter 8, Economic Control and Totalitarianism, with a quote from Belloc. The control of production of wealth is the control of human life itself. Is Hayek's work inspired in part or to some extent by Belloc? Was it just one of many sources which influences Hayek's work?
I think the right way to characterize it is the latter, one of many sources. Hayek definitely appreciated the importance of private property. And one of the reasons he appreciated the importance of private property was he read a great many people who convinced him, contrary to his earliest flirtations with socialism in the years after the First World War, that a private property-based economy was a necessary bulwark for both rationality and economic order, right? Having coherence in the economy, as well as protecting basic human liberties that he cherished. And so I don't want to go too far and say that he was strongly influenced by distributism. I don't think he was, but he was certainly conversant with Belloc and perhaps even Chesterton. And I think that in some respects, he's following grounds and covering themes that the distributists were also concerned with. It's obviously it's easier to spot their divergences given the future trajectory that Hayek went down. And I'm very much in the Hayekian strain in terms of how I think about societies and the limitations of knowledge, the division of labor, private property, and these sorts of things. But also Hayek picked that quote to start that chapter for a reason. He chose that epigraph for a reason. And I think it's because on the foundational issue of property, he appreciated the social role of property in coordinating social systems and as well as preventing the tyranny of man over man.
And the books you've selected to represent the distributist tradition and argument are by early exponents, Belloc and Chesterton. Do more recent distributists, let's say E.F. Schumacher, Joseph Pierce, or Jean Madaille, make any significant contributions? Do they bring distributism up to date in any way?
They apply distributism to contemporary issues. They do that, not always convincingly in my view. It's not that I dislike those books that you just mentioned. The reason that I advocate going back to Chesterton and Belloc is because the themes that Belloc and Chesterton build are precisely the ones that are necessarily enduring. Before you start applying distributism to particular political and economic problems, I think that you need to ground yourself in the principles. Perhaps that's the academic in me speaking. I'm always droning on my students about the fundamentals. And Chesterton and Belloc will get you the fundamentals, along with Wilhelm Repke, a German-Austrian economist who perhaps we can spend a few minutes talking about later.
Distributists appeal not just to Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, but also to Pius XI's 1931 sequel, the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. There Pius argues that society works better when orders or guilds do not just have an economic role in the labor market, but a broader social role. The Germans talk about the Berufsstandische Ordnung, the vocational order. What do you make of distributism's corporatism?
When I look at distributism's corporatism, I see something that's good and salutary and something that I'm a little more hesitant about. The good and salutary part is recognizing that you cannot siphon off economic life. You cannot silo off, I should say, economic life from other aspects of life. The economic is going to impinge on the political, the social, or the religious. And to the extent that you have these worker cooperatives or trade groups or even guilds that can inform via institutional means a wider group of protections, a wider group of associations that help us realize that fullness of life, that's definitely something that's good. And I would like to see something more like that. At the same time, what's distinctive about a guild system is the idea that the guild is going to have for lack of a better term, an institutional monopoly on who practices the trade and the terms under which they practice the trade. And I'm more convinced than not that the medieval guild system in particular was primarily used by the High Middle Ages, if not later, as a way of protecting established insiders against competition from outsiders. I'm not very much a fan of this idea of a permission-based society. It makes me, as an economist, uncomfortable to say, if before you go out and start making shoes, you need to get the permission of in some way of people who are already there making shoes. We can, I think, immediately see the incentive problems with that. People do not like being competed against because that's the source of their livelihood. And so to the extent that you have a small number of groups that are going to be in charge of production, if they have veto rights over other entrants into the field, that's just another kind of monopoly. Every bit as pernicious as a corporate monopoly. And so that's something that does worry me. I think the right way to strike this balance is to encourage efforts that can result in the formation of worker cooperatives and similar groups without necessarily granting them the legal privilege to say, okay, we allow you to produce, but this guy over here, no, we're not going to allow him to produce, or at least we're going to dictate to him the terms under which he produces. And I think the long run dangers of that are not necessarily immediate distributions of income, but long run innovation. Because in the long run, the only reason that we get economic growth is because we create new production processes, we create new technologies. And in order to do that, we have to discover them and we have to test them in actual economic practice. And I worry that giving established producers veto rights over experimentation and new forms of production would significantly hamper that economic growth process.
I also think that the cooperatist argument underestimates the risks of ideological capture, which we're seeing play out in quite a lot of institutions nowadays, where people who don't at all or agree with a certain line in an industry or a sector are excluded unfairly. That'd be one of my concerns with unmitigated cooperatism.
It would make canceling even easier than yes. It currently is, for example.
Chesterton's slogan for a distributive manifesto was 3 acres and a cow. Obviously, this is a somewhat fanciful proposal. I can't imagine Chesterton ever managing to maintain himself with 3 acres and a cow, let alone work the land. However, some contemporary distributors and fellow travelers advocate agrarianism and a back to the land movement. Are there any merits to such a proposal?
The merits to the proposal would be the immediate conferral of economic independence. This idea that if you're working your own land under your own terms, it's much harder for someone to dictate you the terms of your sustenance. The problems with that are much more obvious, I think. We have about 8 billion people in the world right now. You simply cannot feed the world on a group of small decentralized farms. So if we're going to actually propose that as a mass movement, we have to be prepared to confront the fact that calories from foodstuffs are going to become much more scarce and much more expensive. And that's going to cause significant human suffering in the short run. And so this actually points to another thing that I do not support in distributism, which is sort of the agrarian fancy. It's not that I'm against agrarianism per se, but this idea that we elevate farming and agriculture among other realms of production, I don't think helps us confront the contemporary challenges to our political and economic order. If for no other reason, then people just do not seem all that willing to go out and farm. It's difficult work. It's backbreaking work. There's a reason why at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, millions and millions of workers migrated from the countryside into cities. The cities were crowded. They were unsanitary. The work was often unsafe. The hours were long. And yet in the estimation of the workers themselves, it was still more preferable to farming. And so I think that that poses a significant challenge to anybody who says that we can rest or ground a widespread distributist revival on something like a plan of agrarianism. I think that the agrarian aspect of distributism should be one plank, one part among many in an overall distributist package. We should be able to apply these teachings to all sectors or all segments of the economy. It shouldn't just be another get back to the land movement. I think that strips it of its universality and ongoing contemporary relevance.
Thank you for listening. To read or listen to the rest of this interview and gain full access to our archive, visit fivebooksforcatholics.com and become a premium subscriber. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and give it a top rating on the platform of your choice. That way, more people can discover it. You can also support the podcast and help us produce more interviews like this one by making a one-off donation via the link given in the show notes. As little as $1, £1, or €1 can help and will be greatly appreciated. Thank you once again, and God bless.